We acknowledge the traditional custodians of the lands we are recording from today, the Yugambeh people and the Gadigal people.
We pay our respects to the elders past and present and celebrate the diversity of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples and their ongoing cultures and connection to country.
You're listening to the Mum's Gone Climbing podcast.
We're on a mission to deliver high-quality climbing and adventure resources to badass climbing mamas.
And redefine motherhood one episode at a time.
With incredible guests.
Very bad humour.
And just enough Kleenex moments to keep things interesting.
So grab yourself a cuppa or plug us in on the way to the crag.
As we bring you the latest beta from the Mum's Gone Climbing crew.
Hi guys, welcome to the show. I am Eva Rosenbaum.
And I am Nell Gow, and we will be your hosts for today's Mum's Gone Climbing podcast episode, which is quite amazing and very special because who do we have on this episode, Eva?
Lynn Hill! Oh my gosh!
Lynn Hill. We're going to touch on that little conversation and the beauty of it all soon. But to start with, as usual, we're going to give a huge thanks to our sponsors, Arc'teryx, Urban Climb and Climbing Anchors. It's so great to have these guys on board for this episode and for all of our episodes in Series 3. And I also was thinking the other day, Arc'teryx has already kind of been a special part of our journey because, as most of you would know, we had the Mum's Gone Climbing doco come out a couple of years ago now. And since that first premiere, it's, you know, gone around the world in a few different film festivals like the London Mountain Film Festival, Kendall Mountain Film Festival. Mm-hmm. And one of the ones it's been in is the Vancouver International Mountain Film Festival. And that was earlier this year. And within that film festival, we were part of the Arc'teryx Climbing Show. So that was with four other incredible climbing films. It was such an honor to be part of that festival. And Arc'teryx is like their major presenting partner. So that's pretty special. And I think sometimes, you know, we go to these events and we see all the sponsor, you know, info and it kind of just goes over your head. But they're actually like a really, really integral part of, you know, film festivals and podcasts and all those sorts of things. Like these beautiful stories and conversations can't happen without their support. So I think it's nice to reflect on that for sure.
Absolutely. And it's also fabulous to have the wonderful Climbing Anchors on board again for Series 3. I think we've spoken a lot about some of their areas of specialty, like what's your favourite, Nell?
Oh, gosh, here we go. The hot sauce, of course.
The hot sauce, yeah. Right. So now I have a new one. Are you ready?
I love it. Yeah, I'm good for it.
You tried the Boot Banana Eco.
What is a Boot Banana Eco?
Right? You just like you hear it. You're like, what is that? Go to their website and check it out. It's unreal. It's like a shoe insert, right, for your climbing shoes to get rid of, you know, that like really lovely aroma that we all get from our climbing shoes.
I don't know what you're talking about. My climbing shoes smell like
yours, but mine. Yeah, I'm sure. I said that about
you. Do you use these bananas? Do you have
them? Well, no, I've got some on order because I left my shoes in my bag, yeah. And then, you know, new mum didn't climb for a month and, you know, it wasn't very pleasant. But they're made from home compostable deodorizing inserts.
Oh, my gosh. I love
like
this.
I think it's like the only thing out there. Well, anyway, it was the only thing out there that I could find. So
I love this. You're going to have to – I would like you to report back on the banana
the
inserts.
Aroma of my climbing bag.
I love it. I've got to get a couple of things from them as well, including some hot sauce and a new prosic. And I'm going to set up like a little anchor station at home to practice belay anchors and stuff because of something else Eva and I have going on that you're not going to know about yet. It's a secret. Anyway, moving on from that, our last sponsor is Urban Climb. We love these guys. They have gyms in Queensland and Victoria. They have three in Brisbane. Urban Climb at West End, at Milton and Newstead, and one up in Townsville. And they have two gyms down in Victoria at Collingwood and Blackburn. We were actually there with a whole crew of mums at the West End gym on Friday night, and it was
how good.
Oh my gosh, it was so great. We had our pregnant mamas there. We had like a lot of people who were there from like the very first meetup, so it was super special. And another special thing is our Melbourne Mums Gone Climbing community has kicked off. And
welcome Melbourne.
I know. I'm so excited. And that's like really built in the last couple of weeks with some like quite a few new members coming on board. And they're having their first meetup on Friday, the 12th of May. It's a Mums Climb night. It's at Blackburn in Victoria, down in Melbourne. So if you haven't, please jump onto our website. You can connect to our Facebook pages through there and get on down to that meetup. It's going to be great.
Awesome. I can't wait to hear how it goes. Meetup number one.
I know, Paul. So exciting.
Well, the Sydney crew, actually, there's a couple of things we need to talk on that point. The Sydney crew a couple of weeks ago got outside. We did Shandy, which is a very cool multi-pitch in the mountains. It was such a good day. Like it was just... it was epic. So to the mums who joined us, a massive thank you. And to the legendary Hugh at Blue Mountains Climbing School, thank you, thank you, thank you. I can't wait for the next one. One more thing on the Sydney community. Later today, we've got meetups being announced on socials for the next 3 months. So keep an eye on that. If you haven't got on the poll, jump on now and do it because you can sort of influence when they happen. But on that note, so like Melbourne, Sydney... Nell, tell us what's been happening around the world.
So I think our little podcast and our little documentary are getting around, and we've had like quite a few people reaching out to us in the last few weeks wanting to either facilitate meetups within our existing communities or start communities of their own in their own areas, which is really wonderful because I think our local communities are such – I mean, that's how it all began really, and they're so integral to – the connections within the Mums Gone Climbing community. So we've got, yes, we've got Brisbane, we've got Sydney, we've got Melbourne. Hobart is going to be having their first meetup next week. Oh my gosh, it's coming. Perth has also come on board, and we've also, you know, we've got Vancouver still going along and doing their meetups as well. And we've also had Belgium and the Netherlands come on board in the last month. So all of those communities have their own, you know, group on Facebook. So you just need to get to our website, look it up, and you can connect with these mums. And we're so stoked that this is happening. I'm also going to be putting up our May meetups on Instagram tomorrow in all the different locations. So jump on there. Check it out.
How cool. It's literally Mums Gone Climbing worldwide.
Yeah, this is just, we're just trying to build that community so we can go on a worldwide tour and stay with all our friends. Love it. So good. So, yeah, that's all of our news that we needed to catch you up on. Thank you if you've stayed with us because I know it's been a little bit of an essay today. Me and Ever like, geez, this is quite the intro. But, let's talk about Lynn because it was so surreal having this conversation with this woman who I guess has been so influential in both of our lives and climbing, and she's such a beautiful human. Like, I don't know how else to explain it.
Yeah, absolutely. And so humble and just with such a fresh and I think really inspiring approach and view on how motherhood and climbing combined. I found it really refreshing. It was a really beautiful take on it. And you'll hear it.
You'll hear it. Yeah, no, definitely. I think it was really nice for me to hear her talk more about motherhood because I haven't really heard much of her story through that journey. And so much of it was just like, oh my gosh, this is it. This is the journey we all go through. Like, she's Lynn Hill, but she's still struggling with so much stuff that we like that all mothers struggle with. And I think that's, I don't know, it's that deep thing that connects you, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Anyway, enough faffing about. Let's get into it because it's an amazing episode and so excited to share it with you guys today. Hi, Lynn. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello, how's it going?
It's going good. We are so very excited to have you here, and I'm so grateful for your time and for, yeah, for good chats.
Thank you. I probably should have said, how you going? Isn't that how you say it down there?
That's pretty good.
How you going, mate?
How you going, mate? Yeah.
This is awesome because we've had a bit of a theme going through our podcasts of trying different accents because we're talking to people in Canada, in America, in the UK. I like to think I have a good UK accent, but it's been quite fun. But, yeah, if you're being really Aussie Ocker, you'd be like, how you going, mate?
How you going, mate? My son is really good at doing that.
He
can do several accents. Yes, it's quite funny.
I love people who can do lots of accents. It's a lot of fun. I tried to do it when reading to the kiddos. Are you good with accents, Eva?
No, not in the slightest. Every accent I try and do apparently sounds Indian. There is some Indian in my grandparents, so maybe that's why. But no, I'm terrible.
Gotta have a good ear, I think.
I've also, it's all about how you shape your mouth as well, if you're really good at, who knows. We're really going off on a tangent here. Okay, so I thought we'd start off with this question, which I think is probably a bit of a big question, but I don't know. I think it's something that you'll be able to answer really well because I've just heard you talk about this so much. Yeah, I think one of my favorite things about, you know, reading your book, Climbing Free, I've read, or your articles, or just different times I've seen your commentary in movies. I love reflections you have on the experiences you've been through and also your reflections on your own behavior. So just wanted to ask, what is one of the big life lessons you've learned from climbing?
Well, I think that climbing for me, if you were to just stand back and look at what it taught me, is a lot about the ego. And the ego is kind of a big word, but when I'm talking about the ego, I mean just your willingness and openness to learn and be humble and not have to have the results a certain way to have meaning or to feel good about yourself. Like your self-image doesn't have to be related to how well you perform that day. How well you perform that day is something that you take away and learn from and maybe just say, okay, today was either not a great day and you're distracted or tired or whatever, and you just accept that and do your best and, you know, just relax about being critical of yourself. And then other days, you know, you just look at the rock and you get that tingly feeling inside and you know you're going to climb well. And those are the days that we all look for, those flow state days. And that, those are the days where you don't have a lot of internal dialogue going on, this self-talk saying negative things maybe that would be a distraction. You're just totally engaged in the moment. And I think that's one of the great things about climbing is it's this kind of meditation that takes us out of our daily mindset, you know, the more left brain, or I guess the general functioning part of your brain that manages all the details and things. I find brain neurology pretty interesting when it comes to climbing, apart from the philosophical stuff, but maybe it's all just related. But the left brain, right brain versus the corpus callosum that manages the two aspects. And so the right brain is probably the stronger one for that fluidity and flow state, because it's looking at things in general pictures and figuring out the rhythm and the general strategy, I guess. And then the left brain would be more looking at the minor details, feeling the minutiae of your push-pull between your hands and feet, where your center of gravity is, and maybe consciously making a decision to either jump or to try to reach a hold and those kinds of things. But I think that when you're climbing really well, you just kind of are using all your faculties in a very blended way.
As you said, there are these days where you turn up to the crag and everything feels tingly. I love the way you said that. And, you know, you get on the rock and you there's just that confidence and knowing that everything's going to piece together exactly perfectly without forcing it, I guess. And then there's those days where you turn up and it almost feels like you've got Elvis leg before you even touch a hold. Have you found over the years ways Like, is there, do you think there's reasons why there's some days that are so good and some days that are not? Or is it just a flow that happens through life?
I think there are probably a number of factors, some of which we may not be as conscious of, subconscious factors. But I do think that your mood and your focus is affected by emotional things. Say you had an argument or whatever, just a disagreement or something that you feel bad about, that's going to be on your mind a lot. And you probably won't be as focused. So you won't be engaged in seeing the rock the way you would if you just were kind of blank slate, you know, just looking out and seeing what you see and letting your brain do its work, the brain and body, mind, body.
I really love, I don't think we've ever on the podcast spoken about, you know, how neurology and neuroscience and neurophysiology plays into how you move on the rock. Like, I think that's, that in itself is a fascinating topic.
Certainly. There's a lot to be said about even just body awareness. I think that's a huge factor.
Yeah.
When, you know, watching certain people climb, you can tell they're looking through their eyes at the rock and they don't have any idea what the rest of their body might look like in its configuration. And for me, I've developed this association of being able to imagine myself from an associative perspective or from a perspective of an observer. Associative would be looking out your own eyes. And I think gymnastics helped for that. Although gymnastics is a lot faster. You know, when you're doing a flip, you only have time to do like maybe three steps to prepare your brain for what you're going to do. So a round off back handspring is the first thing that usually gymnasts do in tumbling moves, sequences. And then they'll jump and they'll either do, you know, backflip, full twisting, somersault or whatever. So you work through the basics. You learn how to do the round off back handspring and you've got that. And you could do a round off back handspring and jump really high. And then you add either the twist or a double backflip. And it's really a simple move. So you have three things to think about, you know, just hitting the punch. So flying up straight up as high as you can. Then you're going to grab or turn. And then you see the ground and you land. And hopefully you're going to end up upright. So you don't have enough time to really think about things like you might in climbing, but I think that keeping it simple is helpful. And so I try to think about the angles of force when I see a hold, for example, either it's a hand or a foothold. I'll look at exact shapes and try to pull perpendicular or push perpendicular to the angle of that hold. Even though your body's moving, it's like that game of Twister. You want to keep that pressure on your hands or feet in exactly that way. And your elbow and your heels are like rudders in that game, you know, because depending on the shape of the hold, you're going to have your wrists, you know, on a horizontal hold, and you're probably going to face straight towards the face. Or if you have a vertical hold, you'll kind of turn usually, maybe back step with one foot, depending on where the next hold is. This is kind of getting into, you know, my climbing technique video, which I've just released. And it's, you know, I'm trying to simplify it for people and put graphics on it so that they'll have a mental picture of these forces and how to imagine it so that it's easier. It kind of short circuits all the stuff. You know, you have like an endpoint goal in your brain and you work towards that. And through experience and actually trying it, you'll get better at it. And then watching people, you'll see a lot more of what I'm talking about. And I think it helps to watch people climb, especially good people. It's very informative. And especially if you know what to look for, like, what are they doing? Are they squaring up? You know, there's a lot of geometry in good technique. And you can see it when you watch people climb. Or you can also see it when people are putting their foot in the wrong spot, or just, you know, turning the wrong way and just kind of wasting energy and holding on, you know, over gripping and that sort of thing. You can pretty much tell. And it's a subconscious probably that's picking up on it. But if I ask somebody, why did that person fall? Would they be able to answer it? You know, so being conscious of the techniques is really helpful, I think.
Do you think that being that consciousness around the techniques is something that some people are just really intuitive around?
Absolutely. Okay, so let me back up. Intuitive is definitely how I was informed about these things. And being conscious of it, just, you know, in a thinking state of mind, say you're watching a video, that's the thinking state of mind. When you're climbing, you might have snippets of those images, but it's really quick. It's not like you're thinking. You're not having a dialogue. It is intuitive when you're actually climbing. That is what we want. It should feel natural, but you can do things better with small adjustments and technique. And it's like anything. If you repeat the same climb, maybe, you know, the first time you struggle through it, the second time it's still hard and sticking points, but a really hard move at the end of 10 or whatever repetitions on that same climb or move, boulder problem, you'll feel so different because you've figured out all of the push-pull forces and where to shift your body. And it's all about timing and applying force in exactly the right combination.
Yeah, no, definitely know that whole process and the difference between that first time and the 10th time you do it. It's just phenomenal. And I guess that's also feeds into the when you can become so intuitive and you've had that experience that you can look up and see where your force is going to go, where you're going to go. I think then that's easier to slip into that flow state as well, because it just goes from one to the next to the next. It's quite intuitive. And there's not that overthinking. Yeah.
I think intuition is informed experience. It resides in your subconscious, but it is informed, and it's based on your library of movements too. Like you've been in these different situations where you have a hold that's like this, and the next one is over in the quadrant over there. So you're going to cross over like this, and it might be good to imagine imaginary line this way and push off with a foot. So I know where to look for a foothold to get me into the position that I need to be in. So it's about anticipating the right positions as well.
Yeah, I love that. And we are definitely going to talk more about the fundamentals of climbing, the new video you put out.
Yeah, yeah.
Later mm-hmm. on. And all of this is exactly why when I saw that you were bringing that out, I thought, oh my gosh, Lynn is the perfect person to do something like this, just because of your awareness. And
I also think we've just named the episode. I'm going to write that quote, intuition is informed experience. That's fantastic.
That's awesome.
Speaking of intuition, I want to go back, Lynn, like all the way back sort of 19, 20 years ago and talk about your pregnancy, if that's okay, and you know, after you gave birth, because, you know, nowadays we see a lot more, I guess, on social media of climbers at different levels, elite athletes, social climbers navigating pregnancy and motherhood and the transition that's needed physically and mentally to keep climbing. And I'm really interested in hearing a bit about how that was for you and whether, you know, you were climbing already at such an elite level. Were you apprehensive? Were you nervous? Were you feeling completely comfortable with it? How was that transition for you?
Well, I was relatively old when I got pregnant. I was 41. And I wasn't really too concerned about the pregnancy itself once you get past the first trimester. But I was, you know, obviously concerned that there might be, you know, some problems at birth, or, you know, you want to make sure that you have a healthy kid, and it's just, you know, hope that you're going to have a healthy kid. I mean, I obviously did some tests to make sure that his genetics was good and all that, but you don't know what you're going to get. You know, I'm one of seven kids in my family, and it's every one of us is different. So yeah, it's just the luck of the draw of your genetics from your grandfather or grandmother coming down through your kid. It's pretty interesting to see the traits skip generations and what they'll take of you or the father. And it's just an amazing adventure. So I didn't really have any serious problems being pregnant. I mean, the usual things that women go through, you know, especially at the end with a giant belly, you know, sleeping with pillows around, and like, you know, you get a little bit uncomfortable and you're like, I just want to have this baby in my arms. And, you know, a lot of women climb right up until birth. And I decided that it was fine for me not to climb. I didn't really like wearing those big harnesses. And when I got to be about 5 months pregnant, I thought, I'll just, you know, we adopted a puppy. So I just went on hikes and prepared the house, did my little nesting instincts. And, you know, I kept myself plenty entertained. And it didn't really bother me that I wasn't climbing for that period of time. A lot of people think that they have to stay fit all the time. But I also think that when your body's changing and creating another human, the energy could be better spent just doing that. And I don't really want to push my body in ways that, with the hormones, the extra laxness in my my ankles or my hips might be a problem. I mean, it probably isn't, but I just figured it didn't bother me.
There's certainly evidence that there's, you know, laxity, but I love hearing that, because that's a very different tone to, I think, what's quite commonly experienced and certainly projected on social, you know, like, I did this through pregnancy, which is fantastic, but it's lovely to hear that other side of surrender and, you know, respect for what your body's doing, because it's a huge.
Yeah. So it didn't bother me, because I actually wanted to honor what was happening and not let, again, the ego comes up again, let my ego get in the way of, I have to be, I'm identified as, and if I'm not doing that, I'm not who I am. No, you're going through pregnancy. That's a part of who you are too. That's a beautiful part of being a woman and being a human in this world. Is, you know, it's just a magical thing to have a kid. And it's a lot of responsibility, not to say it's all just magic. I mean, there's, you know, the whole stages of the poop in the beginning and whatever. That didn't bother me. For some people, that's really hard, but I, you know, that's not a big deal for me at all either. The stages of watching a baby grow into an adult, you know, it's, you kind of see from a very beginning stage what the personality is. So you're 7 months,
Isabella, she's 7 months.
Isabella. Yeah. So you, what you see in her personality, you'll see into her adulthood, and you can see some things for sure, temperament wise.
You really can. I would definitely, I mean, yeah, 7 and 10, you obviously have your 19-year-old, but definitely from those first few months, there's been stuff that it's so them and it's still so them now. And I think, yeah, I definitely resonate with what you said a lot of, you don't choose who comes to you. I don't think I fully understood that before I had my own children. And it's been, yeah, I guess a bit of an awakening, but a really nice one, because they just come with so much of their own stuff, and it's really about accepting that little soul and like what they're bringing to the world, because yeah, they've definitely marched their own path for sure.
My mother used to say, I march to the beat of my own drummer. And then recently she asked me on this note, kind of, why do you think you are the way you are? You know, like, I'm not the girl next door, was another way of putting it, but my independence and I guess my lack, or I don't know if it's a lack, but I don't really depend on what other people think to make decisions for myself. And I've been like that since I was a kid, because, you know, being a tomboy as a little girl sounded a little bit like an insult. You know, you're not a girl, you're a tomboy, because you like to do physically active things. And it was just our culture not really recognizing athleticism and just the beauty of a young girl being in command of her body in such an amazing way. And I knew that somehow it was all felt wrong to me to feel bad about it and then do something that I didn't want to do, you know, like suddenly get interested in crafts or whatever. Or, you know, I did have a Barbie doll, I guess, but you know, all the girls, I don't think I did much with it though. You know, it's just one of those things you get at Christmas, but, yeah,
they have climbing Barbies now, so maybe.
Oh,
yeah. There's when the Tokyo Olympics came out, they released climbing Barbie.
Oh,
the gear's not very correct that she's got. She's well, there.
I did have a baby. I still have it in my closet. I should have brought it out. It looks like a real baby, and when it was one Christmas and we were shopping and I saw this in the store and I said, Mom, I want that. And she's like, oh no, we can't afford it. And so that Christmas, it was the last gift. And it was just so sweet because I really wanted it. And I thought, well, you know, it was too expensive. You know, I have lots of brothers and sisters, can't have everything. So it was sweet to have that baby. And then I allowed my sister to let her girls play with it. So it's a little bit ripped up arm in one spot, but you know, I can fix that. So it's been passed down. And
it's been loved.
It's been loved. Well loved.
Aww. It's so nice. I think you recognize once you become a parent yourself, like, that moment in itself would have been so special for your mom as well, because she's like, I'm hiding this thing that Lynn really loves and that she doesn't know is coming. And then you like gift your child this, like, it's like, ah, it's very special. And it's so nice that you've kept it as well and passed it down. It's beautiful.
It was meaningful. Yeah, it was definitely a meaningful gesture. And for whatever reason, I guess, because I wanted to have a kid, you know, I always wanted to nurture a baby and, you know, see where that goes. And here we are. We're still on that adventure.
still. It keeps
always.
Going. Yeah. Always. And it's always a joy. What do you think was your biggest challenge through motherhood as far as how it impacted your climbing career? And what wisdom did you gain from, like, navigating that particular challenge?
Well, obviously you have certain limitations. You can't just leave and go for long periods of time without your kid. You could take your kid, and I did. I traveled a lot until my son was school age. And then it was like, okay, no more climbing camps, because it was actually emotionally painful to be I did go to Italy for one climbing camp, and it was 10 days, and my son was only 2.5 and 3.5. I did it 2 years, and it was just terribly painful. I didn't like that. And actually, I think it was 3.5 and 4.5. But anyway, so balancing your career so that you're able to either, like me, take your kid and figure out a system for doing your work, whatever that might be, or a husband, or, you know, daycare and that sort of thing. And then the other thing for climbers in particular, and this is probably more relevant to just going out and climbing, it's really important to have friends that have kids that your kid can play with. Otherwise, it's a very selfish thing, in my opinion, to drag your kid to the cliff and say, hey, go play in the dirt, whatever. And a lot of kids can do that and like doing that. My kid wouldn't do that. I mean, it wasn't something that he was into. But if I brought another kid and there was something for them to do, and sometimes he agreed to climb and he liked it, but mostly he didn't agree to be a climber, because I think it was just too much to have his mother be this famous climber that people would look at me and, you know, kind of say hi to him, but like the focus was on me. And I think it's just too much pressure to compare yourself with that. And, you know, maybe a different temperament would like that, because my friend Robin has two kids. Obviously, one of them was in the Olympics. She was the first person on the American Olympic team for climbing. And Sean is an amazing climber. I think he's done maybe the hardest boulder problem in the world in Switzerland, in the Magic Forest. And he's holding on to the footage. I'm pretty sure they filmed it, but he's one of these people that...
Was this recently? I feel
it
like,
was that a not so recently that we shouldn't have seen it already, but I think he likes to keep people in suspense and just be like, yeah, I did this really hard boulder problem, but yeah, you'll have to wait. But anyway, they love to climb. It's a whole family that climbs. If anything, Didier is the one that didn't climb for like 15 years. He was into cycling. And that's a completely different sport from climbing, you know, just the same movement. Maybe you're going in different terrain, and there's a strategy for sure. But I like the novelty of climbing, newness, new routes, or just new experiences and in movement. It's not just efficiency in that one kind of motion of cycling. And not to make it sound super simple, it's just that it's more repetitive than something like climbing for me.
Yeah. Well, particularly, I think you've done so many different styles of climbing as well and in different terrains. So
sure.
You've really had a very broad experience.
Yeah, I love that.
Speaking of your experience, so like you, I mean, you're regarded as one of the best female climbers in the world. You've certainly had a massive, massive, massive impact on the sport. And I'm interested in how your relationship over all these years of climbing and everything that you've experienced along the way and then motherhood as well, like how has your relationship with climbing continued to evolve through that?
I really couldn't afford to climb as much as I wanted to, honestly. As a single mom, which I was at a pretty young age with my son, he was about 2.5, and he and my ex and I decided that, you know, we're just two different people. Let's, you know, go in our separate ways. And that's hard because I picked up pretty much all the jobs, you know, and he would see his son, but not, I mean, being a mother in this case, and in general, I think most mothers would agree that they're doing the lion's share of caretaking. But when you have to make a living too, and the way that I made a living at that time was very difficult to predict. It's not like, you know, I get up at this time and I go to work, and it became more systematic when it came for school, but I had to fit in whatever my work was in a way that worked for that schedule, which is pretty limiting if you're like this international climber. So that was a sacrifice to give up the freedom to travel like I used to. And I'm still looking forward to picking that up again. I feel like it's been 20 years since I've been free to actually do what I would like to do fully. And so, I mean, I had to work a lot, and people don't understand, you know, they look at me and they're like, oh, you're so successful. And they assume that means that I'm rich and, you know, subsidized somehow. And it's not like that, you know. I think women, somebody sent me this, a little quote from what was in Hillary Clinton's book. And it's something like, it was about the women's role versus the man's. And, you know, you had to think like a man, act like a woman, look like a young woman or something, and work like a horse. And, you know, it's like, you really have to do a lot. And men, I think, typically have had it easier in the structure of, you know, what's acceptable. And, you know, look at, you know, our sport, all the men that are successful, who have kids, have wives that are totally supported, that, you know, are, you know, there to take care of the kid whenever they need to. And it was kind of the opposite for me. I pretty much had people asking me to do things all the time, including things like interviews. It's really pretty much a constant ask. And when in that day of your life do you have time for yourself in the end? You know, you're dealing with helping your child, take him to school, whatever. And my son wasn't the easiest child either. He had ADHD, so, you know, other parents would be reluctant to take him to their house. So I would be the one to host other people's kids so that I could manage it, you know. So not only was my kid difficult, but I had more work on top of that, plus all the free work and solicitations and, you know, and then the work that actually pays. So in the end, I decided that I was older. I didn't have the ability to provide what sponsors wanted, apparently. They want you to be doing the next accolade of the fastest, the longest, the hardest, the most exotic. And, you know, I'm not 30 years old, you know, wearing a bikini when I do it either. So, you know, I decided that really it would be best to be an adult finally, you know, something that I never really figured out how to do, you know, exactly. Well, being adult's fine, but like, when you're asked as a kid, what do you want to do when you grow up? My answer was pretty much something in the health related field, which I think I did succeed at doing. And I studied biology in college. So I have a degree in biology. I nearly went into physical therapy, but I was kind of kidnapped, I would say, by the outdoor industry a bit. And well, really it was Europe that kidnapped me. In spirit, they offered free trips Like the first two trips I went to Europe was Italy and then France the same summer in 1986. And they had prize money. I mean, I didn't understand what was going on with a lot of the conversations because they were speaking French or Italian or German or whatever. But then I got to meet the English people, and that was cool. Ben Moon and Martin Atkinson, Chris, why am I spacing out on his last name? Anyway, a lot of really amazing people. And we were all just rock climbers getting together, having kind of like a party. And yeah, there was the excitement of the competition and the anxiety that we had to manage. And just for me, it was completely bizarre because I'd never seen limestone before. And they made this competition on rock with these banners, and they were chopping down trees over here so that people could see. And I was like, this is so different than the environmentalism of our country and just like this contrived environment. And we only had like 9 minutes to do the climb, and climbing fast was never something I thought about. It was just more about taking your time and making a good decision. Because when I started to climb, the first rule was don't fall, because if you did, you could probably hurt yourself. And you know, I didn't place gear the very first time I went climbing, but that was pretty much what we learned to do, was place gear in cracks. And that's, those were the classic climbs that we did. And if we did a face climb, it was old run out climb with quarter inch bolts that were probably not that safe, because the person who put the route up had to stand there and hand drill the bolt. And it takes like 20 minutes and your calves are screaming standing there on a face. So people didn't put that many bolts in. Plus bolts were considered, you know, kind of the last resort, and, you know, only if it was going to save you from dying, but otherwise try to do it leaving no trace.
Very different to then the sport competitions you found yourself in Europe.
Absolutely.
What about now? Like, what about when you go out climbing now? Like, how is it?
Well, it's part of my life in such a deep way that, I mean, it's part of my community. It's part of how I make a living. It's on a deeper level, it's something that makes me feel good. It's kind of like people who practice yoga. If they don't do it, their body doesn't feel the same. And their, I don't know, your mind, your mood. If I can't climb, it's almost like I go into a depression, not a real one, but I've noticed a slight mood change. Like in wintertime, this is like going back like many years ago, thinking about before there were climbing gyms, I'd be living in Europe and I'd be flying for, you know, a couple of whatever, a day and a half, jet lagged, arrive at family's house. And, you know, you want to be polite. You don't want to say, oh, I got to go for a run right now or whatever. You know, I did actually, you know, when you're there for a while, you definitely, you know, have to get out and do something. But one of my family members lived on this beach path where there's this geodesic dome made out of bars, like these I mean, they all have a junction and a triangle. So you could get upside down and you could do movement that felt good to me. You know, it wasn't the forearm burn, but I made myself something that you can buy on the market now. I probably should have put it on the market 20 years ago. It was actually more like 30 years ago, because it was before I climbed the nose. So it was, I had two holds that were kind of a nice shape, ergonomic, and I put them on a piece of wood. And then I just bought this device at a hardware store that's like a round U-shaped thing, and it had a bar across it so you could tighten that around the hold and put it over a bar. So I could take it down to this geodesic dome and hang on it. And I really did notice an improvement. I'm not much a trainer, like especially fingerboard, but I will say that experiment showed me that's actually very effective, you know, if you're traveling a lot, just to hang a little bit, just to keep your fingers and forearms innervated, whatever, a little bit of exercise that otherwise you would lose if you're traveling for a couple of weeks, especially, you know, at that time in my life, I was still competing, and I didn't really compete that long, but I competed for about 6 years. And that was my dog on the bed. You probably heard.
I thought that must have been a dog. Yeah. A dog tag.
Yeah,
shaking.
Yeah, should have taken him off. Oh well, he likes to be where I am. Yeah,
it's fine.
Yeah. So, yeah, training was not my thing, but I think training in those days, now I call it vacation climbing. For me, training was going to Europe and doing like 12 pitches and, you know, working your way up to whatever you could do on site, and then maybe pick a route that you're going to work on, and eventually Red Point and that sort of thing. Nowadays, training and this whole Olympic caliber athlete is just mind-blowing. One thing that I will say, if you're strong enough to be able to do it, any of those 40-degree boards like the Kilter board or the Moon board, these devices are, I think I actually had thought of this before Moon board came out. I didn't have the light idea, though, with the apps and all of that. I just, the only idea that I had was I wanted to create a board that had a specific configuration. It was more like a yoga thing in my mind, so that you go through this, maybe it's a warm up, and you always do this one kind of thing in all the different directions so that you make sure that you use your body in all the different ways. Just like, I mean, yoga is based on 3,000 plus years of, you know, these masters really considering all these things. But I think you could design something that would be, you know, kind of a nice warm up for people to do just to kind of open up their body and realize how to turn their body this way and, you know, whatever, just the whole spectrum. And then on top of that, you could have boulder problems that, you know, at the time I was thinking, oh, well, Chris Sharma could do like the Sharma, you know, really hard boulder problem. And then you just buy the particular holds and do that boulder problem.
Maybe that will be your next project somewhere along the line.
I have so many ideas. It's actually, I mean, it's one thing to have ideas, but then the only way that you're actually going to benefit or anyone's going to benefit from is to actually execute and follow through. And that's actually a little bit harder because sometimes it takes a lot of money to get certain things built and, you know, prototypes and that sort of thing. And then I wouldn't know the first thing about putting together a business plan. I could say, yeah, I think this will sell. Yeah, I think people will like this. But, you know, based on your idea or... So you need to have actually, you know, a business person put that together, I think.
I feel like I have that experience a lot where I'm like, I have this idea, but then the business side of it. My husband keeps telling me I need to stop being doing nonprofit work. He's like, you do a lot of volunteering now. I'm like, but people are happy. But that's it. I think we'll probably wrap this episode up there. And thank you so much for having a chat to us. And we'll be back talking to you very soon in a couple of weeks' time about your fundamentals of climbing and a few other wonderful things. But thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
Yeah, thank you, Lynn. It's been fantastic.
Thank you. Good luck with finishing up all your certifications and with little Isabella.
Thank you.
What are the names of your two?
I have Boston and Ruby.
Boston and Ruby. Very nice.
Yeah. 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 They are awesome. They're all sorts of fantastic.
Great. Well, enjoy.
Thank you.
Thanks, Lynn.
You're welcome.
And thanks again to all our listeners. It's been great to have you with us for this episode. We'll be back again in 2 weeks' time with Lynn. And in the meantime, keep an eye on our socials. We'll be dropping lots of exciting stuff, including all of these great local meetups that are happening around the world. Have a great couple of weeks and happy climbing.